start without them. And the next part of our our program is with Mr. Brett Holcomb, which I didn't have any bio or anything to go by, but I think all of us pretty much know Brent. He's a prolific writer of books, genealogy books, and of course he's selling his books out here, and I recommend every one of them. I have so many of them, and it helps so much with your research. But he's going to talk to us about vinyl records because he's very much an expert on this. So welcome.
Thank you. Y'all have motion for that? No. I also edit the South Carolina Magazine of Adjunct Research and publish this. I don't know how any of you could live without it.
You must like me.
Well, then, I will. Certainly will. My IT person, Eric, is going to turn this machine on when I need it. I'm not high-tech like Lynn is. I don't do PowerPoint. I barely have electricity in the house. So I just do the old-fashioned way. You know, it's hard to find these overhead projectors, and it's hard to keep them working. I needed one for a talk, and I got there, and it didn't work. So I bought one off eBay for like $25, and it worked three times for me. And then the bulb went out, and I think I have one somewhere, but we'll get to that a little later. I'll try to make this as brief as I can, but it's kind of like, you know, the little boy was watching the minister of the sermon and said, you know what it means when he looks at his watch? I said, what? Said, nothing. Talk about South Carolina's vital records. South Carolina did not record birth until 1915. And this can be very frustrating to people from other places like New England who expect town records and that sort of thing to be available. These are on file at the Office of Vital Records in Columbia, but these records are not open to the public until they become 100 years old. That hasn't quite happened yet. And they may change that law. Now, the late birth certificates you can get to, and they're at the archives, but and in fact, I think Ancestry.com has put those online for South Carolina if you wish to work with that. In the Lowcountry parishes, there are extant 7 colonial parish registers with registers of baptisms, death, and or burials and marriages. These 7 parishes are the parishes of St. Philip, which is in the city of Charleston, St. Thomas of Dennis, 1 parish, 2 saints, Prince Frederick Winyall, St. Andrew's, Christ Church, St. James Stanton, and St. Helena. These do not extend into the upcountry at all. I've got a map of these parishes in my guide to research. Prince Frederick Winyall has one of the most interesting registers, as it covered a wide territory, even extending up into North Carolina with some entries in the 1740s. There's an occasional 18th century church record here and there, but the entries only apply to a very small fraction of the general population. Of course, we've already talked today about the Gibson-Banner record, and you're familiar with that. Occasionally, a record of birth or baptism is recorded in the miscellaneous records at the South Carolina Archives, but the reason is not apparent. There are records of baptism, sometimes giving a date of birth or age of the child, and the records of Roman Catholic churches, Presbyterian churches, Lutheran churches, and Methodist churches. The records of St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in Charleston began about 1789 with the formation of that church. By the way, that was the earliest Catholic church in the Carolinas or Georgia. Fishing Creek Presbyterian Church records in Chester County began 1799. There are some Methodist church records in Georgetown and Charleston from the early 1800s, but most Methodist churches do not have records prior to 1850. The St. John's Lutheran Church record, which Lynn talked about this morning, those records began in 1764. They're available on microfilm at the South Carolina Archives. And the originals with indices available are at the church in Charleston. We have some Lutheran churches in the Midlands of South Carolina which begin about 1813 with their records. Ministers' journals occasionally include baptismal records as well. And, of course, you know that there are some errors and omissions in the history of Orangeburg County on the Gissendanner records, but they're now online. This Gissendanner gentleman from Switzerland who came here a few years ago has put that up. There is one record, in fact, it's the online right here. Look at that, isn't that wonderful? It works. This is from the Historical Magazine, and Lynn alluded to this. This is just one page that apparently survived. You can see those records now. Some of those would be names familiar to you.
Yeah. Familiar.
And I think that this may be a page that survived out of the St. Matthew's Parish Register. That's just my opinion. Some cities have birth records, such as Charleston, which began in 1874, and some recently discovered vital records from the town of Florence include Vernon. The Charleston birth records are available on film at the South Carolina Archives and at the Charleston County Libraries. Birth announcements in newspapers are very rare prior to 1900. You know, now they put a birth announcement. Good grief, everybody had a child every 2 years. Why would they put that in the paper? No big deal. I mean, don't have a child every 2 years as long as you have a wife who can have children. Death records in South Carolina began January the 1st, 1915. In some counties, it may have been sometime after that date before they were in full compliance with the regulation. Death certificates are available for research as they become 50 years old. The archive has microfilm of death certificates 1915 to 1962. There's a microbeat index available for these records, except some a little later you have to go online for the index. These are also available on Ancestry.com, but only through the year 1955. So after that, you're going to have to use some other sources. In Ancestry.com, how many have used that? You may have to be a little bit creative. Sometimes they get the first and last name crossed up in there, and it's only as good as what somebody entered, so be careful with that. Images are available on their site, but sometimes I have difficulty printing them out. It depends on the quality of your printer attached to your computer and their image. So you can always get a copy at the South Carolina Archives. Now, you're going to have to go there to do it because they are prohibited from sending those out by mail. That's agreement with the Office of Vital Records. Let me tell you, it took a long time to get that film at the archives. We fought quite a battle with that, but we're glad that the film is there now and can be seen. If you want to get a death certificate after that, you, as one of the first said, you got to be a relative. I said, no, you have to tell them you're a relative. When I used to get some for black clients, I got some funny looks by the clerk. They now charge $15 a piece, and the 2600 Bull Street in Columbia, 29201. You need to write to that address, give the name of the deceased, sex, race, date of death within 1 or 2 years, and the county. A death certificate usually shows the date of death of the individual, his date of birth or age at death or both, the place of burial, names of parents of the deceased, as well as the place of birth of the deceased and the parents, sometimes only a state is given, and the name of the person supplying the information called the informant. This information is also on file at the county health department in the county where the person died, but it's usually better to check the index in Columbia because it's a statewide index. You know your grandmother's buried over here at this church, but you may not know that she died in the next county staying with a child or an accident or something, so it may not have occurred in the county where you think. The information on death certificates is notoriously unreliable because it was furnished at a time of stress. An obituary notice suffers from the same circumstances, so you need corroborating information. When somebody dies in my family, they ask the family idiot for the information. Frequently get it wrong. So you have to check that out carefully. In fact, my great-great-grandmother and great-great-grandfather have the same mother listed on the death certificate. This didn't work out well. Some cities, such as Charleston, have death records and or certificates prior to 1950. The Charleston death records began in 1819. For everyone, white and black, free and slave. Information such as place of birth, length of residence in Charleston, and place of burial is included. The index of these records are drawers in the of cards in the Charleston County Library, and there have been articles written about these by James Hagee in the Historical Magazine, which goes into detail about the history and accuracy of these records. Now, Charleston is interesting. You ever deal with Charleston death records? They, the later ones, maybe staff OT out of town. They were brought there for bear out of town. The death record says, length of residence in Charleston. How long have you lived here? A friend of mine who was a Lutheran pastor there, he was walking through the cemetery and said, I saw this tombstone and said, though not a Charlestonian, he lived among us as a friend for over 40 years. You might find a record of a death in any church of any denomination, including Baptists. Including in the Baptist church records, they're usually found in the membership list. Often there's only a notation, dead, but some churches give exact dates of death. There's some fairly early ones in the Welsh Net Baptist Church in Society Hill, Darlington County. There are some death dates in the Union County Baptist Churches of Paget's Creek and Lower Fair Forest. Obituary notices in newspapers are most helpful. Not every person, of course, would have a death notice. In cities such as Charleston, nearly every person had at least a one-line death notice or funeral invitation was published. Funeral invitations frequently indicate the street address of the person. Again, newspapers were regional, and persons who were very old might have had an obituary notice published. In the South Carolina Historical Magazine, issue of April 1996, there's an article by James Hagee again and Bertrand Van Rumbuyke on the French refugee newspapers of Charleston, including the notices from 1807. Now, in the Carolina Gazette, 30th November, 1811, I would like to read you this notice. Now, this is November, this is it, but died in March 1811 in Union District, South Carolina, in the 96th year of her age, Mrs. Judith Edmondson, a native of Virginia. She was the mother of 11 children, the grandmother of 95, the great-grandmother of 301, and the great-great-grandmother of 15, and all 422. This enumeration was made and certified by Hosea Holcomb and William Jackson, who supposed that several of the descendants of Mrs. Edmondson were not included as being unknown to them. They also added that very few of the 422 were dead at the time of her death. I want to get that list. I saw that notice years and years ago. I said, gosh, that's going to be good for somebody. It turns out to be my ancestor. I didn't know she married again in her old age, and her name had been Smith. In the same issue of the newspaper, died on the 2nd of October last in Greenville District, South Carolina, Colonel John Thomas, aged 93 years. Colonel Thomas was a native of Pennsylvania, was in Braddock's defeat in 1755, in the expedition against the Cherokee Indians in 1762, and served with a reputation to himself and usefulness to his country throughout the Revolutionary War. Now, from the Southern Presbyterian, we have a following item. Entered into rest August 14, 1885, A.G. Sally, who was for more than a quarter of a century elder in the Presbyterian Church in Orangeburg. And we're going to talk a little bit more about newspapers as we talk about marriage. One of the biggest disappointments to researchers is the lack of marriage records for South Carolina. You don't know how many times people come into South Carolina. I want to see the marriage records for Colleton County in 1850. I'm sorry we don't have those. And I was at the desk one day, this listen, they have them, they just won't bring them out. And I want them, sister, if they had them, I'd have published them by now. But our marriage license law begins July the 1st of 1911. They're kept in the probate judge in the county from which the license was issued. Now, the little quirk about that is you could get a license from any county in South Carolina and be married anywhere else in South Carolina. But the license is returnable to the county from which it was issued. Now, a lot of times that doesn't make any difference. But in Columbia, some people get a license in Columbia and get married over in West Columbia in Lexington County, as long as they return it there. They tell a story about a gentleman who started Thompson Funeral Home in West Columbia, that he was a notary and he married people. And a couple would come to get married, and all legal and everything. In 2 or 3 weeks, the parents would call him. You know, they're not getting along at all. I hadn't turned in the lights, but I was terrified. cheap man's divorce. There's no clear reason for the lack of early marriage records, except in the colonial period, The parishes of the Church of England were supposed to record all marriages within the parish, whether or not they were members of the church. It probably was not done. Now, after the Revolution, no marriage license was passed until 1911. Nevertheless, some counties or districts did issue marriage licenses. We have a handful of these, 1780 in Camden District and 96 District. Also, the following counties or districts issued some marriage licenses or bonds, of which we have either recorded copies or originals. Charleston, Chester, Darlington, Fairfield, Oree, Marion, Marlborough, Newbury, Pendleton, Spartanburg, Sumter, and York. We had a Vital Records Act in the 1850s, South Carolina. It was supposed to record the births and the marriages and the deaths, and this was done. We have the statistics, but not the records. We know how many, we just don't know who. Except one marriage returned from Pickens District for 1859 to 60 was found stuck in an old court case, and it was printed in the historical magazine. Now, I think either somebody's playing a joke on them, or they didn't know what they were supposed to do, but it has the names of the parties married, but no, number of marriage, whether it's the first, second, third, or fourth. They got people 21 years, and they old said that this is their fourth marriage. That just can't be. Now, we have a number of marriage settlements in South Carolina, which what we have now would call a prenup agreement. Frequently, these marriage settlements are second marriages for one or both parties, and quite often, family information is found among these by statements of the origins of the property inherited from a relative or obtained in some other way. These marriage settlements are found in miscellaneous records, main series for the colonial period, and 1787 to 1885 in a separate series titled Marriage Settlements at the South Carolina Archives. Some still are recorded in miscellaneous records Columbia series after 1787 for some unknown reason. They were also supposed to be recorded in the deed books for the counties where the couples resided. However, this does not appear to have been consistent. All marriage settlements prior to 1821 were included in my books on South Carolina marriages, 1688, 1799, 1800, 1820, and a supplement in 1984. There is a, I can find my little thing put on the screen here again.
I hope you can see this.
This is a, it doesn't point out too well because it's kind of not fitting on the screen too. So, but anyway, in South Carolina, Orangeburg District, where the marriage is about to be had and solemnized between John Evans of St. Matthew's Parish and Elizabeth Zimmerman of said parish, and it said John and Elizabeth have each respective issue by former marriages and are desirous that their respective children and issue should have the benefit of their respective estates, real and personal. 1st of December, 1825. The witnesses were Adam Dantzler and Jacob Zimmerman. And I'm going to leave a copy of this for Mr. Delp if he'd like to publish it in your newsletter sometime. Now, these volumes that I mentioned do not include any marriages reported in newspapers. I've done a lot of marriage and death notices from newspapers. That's one of my favorite things to do. And prior to the war, one time I said, if you have to ask which war, you shouldn't be in here. And I got a letter of rebuttal about that later on. Everybody here knows what the war was. A marriage from Fairfield District might be found in the newspaper of Columbia, Newbury, or Camden. Greenville newspapers covered most of upper part of South Carolina, 1826 to 63. The religious newspapers should also be consulted. I published the notices from the Baptist newspapers of South Carolina, 1835 to 1887. The Presbyterian newspaper of South Carolina was the Charleston Observer, 1827 to 45. It moved to Richmond, Virginia in 1845, and it was the Watchman and Observer. The Southern Presbyterian was established in 1847 in Milledgeville, Georgia, but the Watchman and Observer continued to include notices from South Carolina. The Southern Presbyterian moved to Charleston and eventually to Clinton, South Carolina, where it was published in the early 1900s, and eventually went to Atlanta. There are notices from Orangeburg District or County in every volume of my abstracts in this publication. I was surprised that there were so many around. It took me about 20 years to do this project because I couldn't get film of the newspapers. And institutions are kind of proprietary about their newspapers, and I don't blame them. They were at Montreat for years. I just tried to make some progress typing out on my laptop. It just too many hours to be involved. So Carolyn Ann said, well, if they will send the newspapers down here, we'll film them, give them back to them, and give them a copy of the film at no charge. We didn't want to do it that way. So I said, I'll even go up there again. No, don't want to do it that way. We're going to get a grant. So they got a grant from whatever Presbyterian they had to film the newspapers. What did they do? They sent it to Carolyn Ann Library to be filmed. This could have been done years before. No, they didn't want to do it. Fine. And Alice Stokes, who was director at the time, was kind enough to let me buy the film as soon as it was issued so I could do this project. And after 20 years, I finally got it done. Y'all know what ARP is, Associate Reformed Presbyterian. When I speak out west, what's an ARP? Associate Reformed Presbyterian. They had their own newspapers published in Due West beginning in 1843. You know where Due West is? It's not Due West of anything. It's one of those peculiarities of South Carolina. You know, it got named that. It was Due East's Corner. It got to be Due West.
East of North, isn't it?
Right, there you go. You've seen that video too, haven't you? North South Carolina. That was one of the funniest things I ever saw Bill Cosby do. The Lutheran Observer was published in Baltimore, Maryland, but it carried South Carolina notices. The Southern Christian Advocate Methodist newspaper was sometimes published in Augusta or Macon, Georgia. The South Carolina Temperance Advocate, and you know what that is, don't you? It was a quasi-religious newspaper, published notices from all over South Carolina. It was published in Columbia for the most part, and I included that in my Columbia newspaper book. There's a marriage of J.M. Pennington of Greenville to Miss Lenora, daughter of Mr. William Price, 1850. Now, all kind of things pop up in newspapers. They think it's funny. Their idea of humor was a little bit different from our stuff. But, by the way, have you watched Who Do You Think You Are? I just think that's remarkable that those people are so dumb. They don't know anything. This girl from Ohio, where she was from. Oh, her ancestor joined the Union. He was fighting for freedom. He was a coder. He wanted a better job. And then he survived the war, but he got taken down to Andersonville prison, and he escaped. And he got shot. He got shot. Well, history's in a war. What do you think's going to happen? And so he got back home, got to be elected sheriff, and then he got to be elected a state senator. And they showed him the newspaper. He was in favor of temperance. She had no idea what that was. Well, you got a lot to learn. But people just don't know these things. But back to the newspapers. This is a notice from the Southern Times and the State Gazette of Columbia, 6th January 1831. The title of the article is Economical Marrying. Now, I have to listen carefully. Economical Marrying. Married on Thursday evening, the 23rd ultimo, by Thomas Johns, Esquire. Mr. John Hendricks to Miss Mary Margaret. Mr. Joshua Hendricks to Miss Sarah Mills, and Mr. Euclidus Hogg to Miss Keziah Martin, all in the same place, all of Newberry District. Four of the persons married are the grandchildren of Mrs. Sarah Margaret, who was present and participated in the festivities of the evening. Okay, three couples got married, four for her grandchildren. Somebody married a first cousin, right? Please have this on open window. Oh, my child's going to marry his first cousin. Okay. They think that's something new. It happened, people. Good grief, Abraham and the Bible married his grandchildren. But also, odd marriages were reported in the newspaper. You know, if Reverend Green married John Red to Miss Mary Blue, they thought that was a colorful marriage. They were crazy. A friend of mine, Ken Thomas, who writes a column in the Atlanta paper on genealogy, was visiting me and was working on his Wilson ancestor in Fairfield County. He found an equity suit that tells him all kinds of stuff. He was thrilled to death. He'd been married three times, and the children were by the first wife, but the last wife was giving them trouble because she wanted her part of the estate, and they didn't like her at all. They had this big, long case drawn out. I said, well, she's not our father's legal wife because she was married before, and she was still, her husband was still alive when she married our father. Well, they get this. No, she was married the first time. Somewhere else. And then she lives in adultery with this other man. By the time she married her father, they were dead, so that marriage is legal, and she gets her part of the estate. But they just hated her. And there was the Mr. Blizzard who kept popping up in the proceedings, and they really didn't like him. And Kent said, I can't figure out who Mr. Blizzard was. And he got home to Atlanta. I found out who. I looked in your newspaper book. Here's the notice. It says, Narrative Fairfield District, near 25 Mile Creek, on Thursday evening, 23rd incident by Mr. Jonathan Watts. Mr. Jacob Blizzard, age 17 years, and Mrs. Wilson, age about 75. Ain't love, Brian. Found out later that, of course, Ms. Wilson didn't live that long, and he married her granddaughter later on. Anything can happen. Now, other places you might not think to find marriage records would be in pension applications. Anytime there's a war, there's a pension involved in there, especially for widows. We're familiar with Revolutionary War pension applications, I'm sure, but also War of 1812, Mexican War, and Confederate pensions may provide some other information. Now, there are Confederate pension applications, and I'd like to show you one of these. They're online at Ancestry.com if you can read them. And this is one, if I can get it up here, we can see the image. John A. Abnett. I'm the widow of John A. Abnett, coming out of Second South Carolina Artillery under Captain Thomas Reed, blah, blah, blah. Discharged 12 April 1865. I married him 14th December 1875. That's very interesting. My husband did not deserve to serve the Confederate States or this state. He died 2nd December 1895. Yet another Bible thing. And goes on that I reside in Orangeburg. I've lived there since the 9th of August 1856. By the way, that's her birthday. L.A.F. So we find all kind of neat stuff, but doesn't give her maiden name. Those things almost never do that. So, how are we going to find her maiden name? This is 1919. Now, our district is in 1915, so she ought to have one. And we found one. L.A.F. They changed her birthday to have it on August 9, 1856, died July 27, 1924. Born in Orangeburg, father William Seastrup, Orangeburg, mother Maxie Cleckley from Orangeburg. Very study side right here in town. But as I said, sometimes the information on these death certificates might not be right. So we go to another record. Let's see if we can find her. Born in 1856. Should she be on 1860 census somewhere, her name? Yes. But man, it takes some creativity. Can you see this right? Spelled with a C? Here she is, under William, 3 years old. Yep, she speaks well. Mother Ann M. Maxie on the death certificate. If she was the Cleckley, you might have to find another record to prove that. But that's how you use more than one record to try to verify things. And I know my time is running short and somebody else wants to speak. So I'm going to stop here and let you ask questions if you have any. Because I know I can't tell you everything I know in 30 minutes. 35. Oh, is that what it was? Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Are there any coroner's jury records in South Carolina?
Oh, yes. That's a good question. We have coroner's inquisitions, they're called. Usually, they're found in the records of the sheriff because those were used in case there was a murder suspected that they would have an indictment. But they survived. They're in the county records. Most of these are at the South Carolina archives now, and you just have to go through them one by one. Some have been published in my magazine and other places. Others are just listed. Sometimes they have a chronological list, but they're worth looking at. In fact, the ones for Union County were found, I'll say 30 years ago. A friend of mine said, your ancestors got a coroner's inquisition. Really? Because all I knew, he died between 1830 and 40. Didn't know anything about him. He did not own property when he died. I knew where he lived because people said, lived over there on such and such a place. Give the exact date of death, 1835, which thrilled me to death. I didn't have it. Told on whose plantation he died, which is what was told. And he died by visitation of God. That's the last time God came to But those aren't very helpful. And the coroner's jury will be neighbors. Everyone who, you know, they come and view the body and say he died of natural causes or died from drowning, whatever. So you'll find the neighborhood there, the coroner's jury. A lot of times they're slave children who died and they would have a coroner's inquisition over it. or if he died by his own hand, it would say so. He murdered by fellow citizens. Now we're going to go to General Sessions' case for that. That's a very good question.
Yeah, was the visitation by God considered natural causes?
Right. I'm going to have a stroke. Yes, sir.
About grand and petty jury.
You usually have grand jury indictments or presentments. Sometimes they survive with the county records, but grand jury presentments a lot of times were to the legislature. They're in what we call the legislative papers at the South Carolina Archives. There is a comm index to them. Sometimes you might do well, instead of looking for individuals, to look at Orangeburg District or Orangeburg County in that index, and it will list all the ones that mention that. You will find a lot of them. If it says grand jury presentments, you can pull those and read them. They're not online yet, I don't think. They may be eventually, but the film is there in the archives and you can see it. Any other questions? Well, thank you. You're wonderful audience.